Okay, the lesson I'll be starting today will actually be two parts. Only one part will be given at this time, this week, because Hugh's back next week. And whenever I get the next opportunity, I'll go into part two. Part one is going to be a biblical analysis on the age of the earth and the universe. And part two, whenever that may come, will be a scientific analysis of the age of the universe and earth. But today, we'll just concentrate on the biblical perspective. I sort of debated with myself and lost. Try that one. Which I should do first. And I'll go with the biblical side first. In the Bible, first, and a lot of you already know this information, but realize that we may have some visitors that may not be cognizant of some of this information, and people listening on the web may not be cognizant of certain aspects or a lot of the information that will be given. And so part of our ministry as a class, even though we may be familiar with some of the material, is to outreach with that material to others who are not. So in the biblical analysis, we'll be first looking at the literal days of Genesis. What does a literal day mean in Genesis 1? And then we will go into days 3, 6, and 7 in Genesis chapter 1 and discuss the contents therein. And then look at Genesis 2, look at its one day, referring back to the 6 days of the first week. So one day equals six. And then we'll look at some other Bible passages and then look at some of the issues that individuals who believe in a young universe might try to bring up to try to refute an old earth perspective. But before I start on this, I want to emphasize that we all should have the humble, considerate, kind attitude that Hugh has demonstrated over the years in discussing this issue. First, it's not a salvation issue. Although some young earthers, young universe people will try to claim it is a salvation issue. And we'll see that argument later. But it's... Yeah, okay. Can we turn just these lights off or as best that we can? No? It's... Okay, and then you don't have to look at my beautiful face. Okay. Well, I'm sure the shock has passed already. That it is not an issue to divide over. We should not berate people of opposing viewpoints on this issue. But it can be a very important issue. As Hugh and others in this class have experienced over the years, many people have come up to Hugh, for example, crying when they realize that they don't have to divorce their mind from their spirituality. When they see that biblical reality matches up to scientific or physical reality. Okay? And so they don't have to put away their intellect because of their faith. We're going to show that the two are very harmonious and consistent with one another. And so it's important in the sense that if people are struggling intellectually, that this can be alleviated, the information that I'll be presenting this week and in part two. That we can love God with all our mind and enjoy science, good science. There's bad science, like there's bad theology out there. And so you have to separate the good from the bad. And that takes some study and objective analysis. And so it'll help people love God with all their mind, which Jesus said, love God with all your mind and, of course, all your heart and all your soul. And so some people tend to ignore the mind part. Josh McDowell once said that the heart cannot truly rejoice in what the mind is not convinced of. Yes?
You said that when you study the Bible and the concept of the old earth matches with the Bible, wouldn't that imply that you are correct and the young earth is wrong?
Yeah, the question is, the statement that since we contend that the Bible is consistent with an old earth and universe, doesn't that mean, therefore, that the young earth people on this point, on the age issue, are incorrect? That is a correct statement. Yes. But it's to be shown with grace and love. So, let's get into... also, I might add that this can be important for people who are examining the faith and have an intellectual problem with it. And this is where their intellectual problem lies, is they think the Bible teaches a 624-day creation of a series of events. And we want to show that it does not, and so that they don't have to worry about the intellectual part of reality when it comes to a biblical faith. But usually, it's not an intellectual problem we're dealing with. It's emotional or a problem of will. But those are other parts of a Sunday school lesson, not today's. Okay, the Hebrew word for day is yom, as much of you, many of you already know. Yeah, the day of. And depending on the context, the word yom can refer to either 12 hours, 24 hours, daylight, or a long but finite period of time. So context determines which of those four literal definitions that we use in the passage. Okay? Now, even today's language in English, we use like the day of the dinosaur, the day of George Washington, or whatever, to mean a non-literal 24-hour day. We mean it to be a longer literal day. So each of the four potential definitions in Hebrew are literal. Not metaphorical, not allegorical, but literal. And context defines how you are to interpret it, in which of those four literal ways. Because in Moses' day, Hebrew only had about 3,000 words. And at Moses' time, when he wrote Genesis, guess what? The word that was used for age, eon, or epoch? Yom. The same word used for a 24-hour day. And so again, context will define how you interpret it. Moses had only one word to use for age, eon, or epoch, and that was yom. So let's see how he meant it in Genesis and elsewhere in Scripture, and not try to impose preconceived ideas as to what it means. Okay? Some argue that, well, it's 24 hours, it's simple, straightforward, it's a day, you know. But I say, when you consider the information that'll be presented, no, that's not the simple explanation. The simple explanation is we're dealing with something longer than a 24-hour day. Okay, in Genesis 1, for the third day, yes?
Sean, I'm a little confused there. We say that Moses wrote the Genesis, right?
Yes.
Was Samuel before him or after? Was Samuel before?
After.
After, because he said, "For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he sets the world on them."
Mm-hmm.
So he thought there was pillars holding up the earth.
No, I would contend pillars in that case are obviously, to any unbiased reading of it, and metaphorical reference. We even today call about the four corners of the earth. Does that mean we literally mean there's four corners and it's a cube? No, of course not. You know, metaphorical. Yeah, and God knew better as well. Okay, the third day it says, God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds," and it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. Now, the context clearly says that the land produced vegetation. That's a process, not a creation event. Obviously, the first vegetation, whether it was full-grown, mature, or via seeds, God created vegetation initially. But then the context clearly states that the plants and the trees were bearing on an ongoing basis seed and fruit. And on an ongoing basis, that takes more than a 24-hour day. Some people, from the young earth position, might try to say, well, God speeded everything up. No, the context does not support that at all. That's reading into the context a preconceived notion. The context clearly says that plants and trees were bearing seeds and fruit. That's a normal process, not a speeded up process. So the day of vegetation, day three, shows a longer period of time. Now let's look at day six. We're looking at context here on how to interpret Yom. In day six, we have multiple events happening. When you look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, 15 through 23. And in Genesis 1, it's 24 through 27. First, God creates three types of land animals. Or, in other words, mammals in this case. Not that all mammals were created on the sixth day, but three types were. And the fossil record supports that these three types of mammals mentioned and on the sixth day were the latter type of mammals to come onto the fossil scene. So we're consistent with the fossil record. So he creates three types of land animals on the sixth day. God creates man on the sixth day. Then it says God plants a garden, the Garden of Eden, on the sixth day. Planting, was that a normal process that God used? That's a question mark. God then puts Adam into the garden on the sixth day. Adam takes care of the garden on the sixth day. Adam names the animals
on the sixth day.
You're getting it. You're getting it. And then Adam gets lonely and wants a mate on the sixth day.
I wish I could get that with Devin one day.
Yeah. Now, does this all sound like one day to you? But we're not done yet. Then God creates Eve on the sixth day. And then Adam says about Eve, basically in the Hebrew, it's better translated. He says at long last. It's that's a sort of a paraphrase of the literal Hebrew, but that's what it means at long last, or it means at long last, or finally. The literal translation is this is now. But if you go to Hebrew commentaries, you'll learn that it has more of a thing like, oh, finally, you know. Now, does this sound like a 24-hour day or a longer period of time?
A longer period of time.
Good. I'll pay you your $20 later. An extra dollar. One time in my apologetics Bible class, I was talking about, you know, a man in total communion with God, you know, direct communication, all that, and he gets singleitis within one 24-hour day. And one girl who had a good reply, I appreciate her humor, she said, well, one day is long for a man. You know. Okay, I'll give you a point. Okay, so let's look at Genesis chapter 2. Yes, Maura?
Just to back up before you go on.
Mm-hmm.
You said Moses only had one definition of day.
Yeah.
But we only have one definition of day, too. I mean, one, he didn't have one definition.
He had four definitions for Yom, yes.
So it's not any different. And I think that's, you know, what, when you're evangelizing, I think that's a good point, because people will say, oh, I don't read Hebrew. You know, I have to read Hebrew to get this. Well, we have the same, you know, definitions for day today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use day in a variety of different ways today. Although we have a broader vocabulary, we have about 4 million words in English compared to 3,000 in Hebrew.
Exactly. But, you know, if they want to pick at that, they really can't, because we have the same definitions today in English that they have.
Okay, the Hebrew gentleman in the back. Now remember, you have 3,000 words to look. Go ahead.
I'm just a short neurotic Jew.
Now, this may sound like a silly question.
Yeah.
What language did Adam speak to God in?
Oh, that's a great linguistics question. What language did Adam speak in? King James English, of course. But the second better answer is nobody knows.
Would it have been Hebrew, maybe?
Probably not, but I can't say. Objectively, I can't say what he spoke. Yes.
John, what is interesting, obviously, is the people that study languages, just as we have the, you know, the DNA, Adam and Eve, and science are talking about, the people that are studying languages are realizing, obviously, that languages had to go back to a common language, that they made a tree, you know, out of that, because, obviously, of the similarities between all the languages.
Yeah, there's a tendency to believe now, if I'm up to date on the information in linguistics, is that ultimately there was one common language at the beginning. Yes?
I would have us consider that when God is communicating to a man and man is unfallen and Adam was unsullied by sin, the communication would have been perfect. In other words, I might describe something in a sentence and you might get 98% of what I was thinking.
Right.
Or if it's my wife, she'll talk by me and maybe I'll get 25% of it.
But your wife gets 98% of what you're saying.
So that's not good. That God, Adam, communication was flawless and perfect.
There might, it might have even bordered on more. And there may have been a lot of nonverbal communication as well because of that total unbroken relationship with God. Okay? Now, later on, Hebrew took on more words and it had more versatility in this area. But not at the time Moses wrote Genesis. Yes?
I've often heard that the language that Adam spoke referred to as Proto-Edenic. Well, there is a name given to it, even though no one has determined that.
Yeah, what it is. That would be fun someday to find what it might have been. Okay, in Genesis 2, it refers back to the day of creation, i.e. of the 6 days of Genesis 1. It says in good old King James, in Genesis 2:4, it says, this is the generations, or account, of the day, singular, of creation. So now one day equals 6 days. Uh-oh, the story's getting more complex. Or not as simple as some try to say. Okay? Now, let's go to the seventh day. Now, you want to try to remember this stuff? Remember 3671, 3671. Third day, sixth day, seventh day.
First day.
And then the one day of Genesis 2 equaling the sixth of Genesis 1. Okay, in the seventh day, it's a very long day. In fact, biblically, we're still in the seventh day. In Hebrews 4, 1 through 11, and I'm not going to read all 11 verses, but it says, quote, for somewhere God has spoken about the seventh day in these words. And on the seventh day, God rested from all his work. It still remains that some will enter, present tense, that rest for the people of God. Let us therefore make every effort to enter, present tense, that rest. So the day of rest of God ceasing from his creative activity, not other activities, but creation activities, is still exists. In fact, Jesus in John chapter 5, 16 through 18 says that Jesus actually defended himself working, quote unquote, on the Sabbath with an illustration that the Father is working on his Sabbath day of rest. Not working in the sense of creation activity, but working in other activities like healing people. For example, when Jesus healed on the Sabbath, the Pharisees thought that was work. And Jesus saying, no, it's not. You know, so God is still in his day of rest, even today. And so the seventh day, by anybody's recollection, is thousands of years, if not tens of thousands of years. Yes?
It could be important to know that science backs that up. And obviously, humans appeared on the scene. We have not had one new species come into existence for a while. 100,000 years.
Yeah. Since mankind was created, nothing new in the fossil record. No new genotypes, shall we say. No new types that can breed just within themselves. Okay? Also, the Bible, and this is sort of a not the coffin of the argument against a short earth, but one of the nails in the coffin. Compare God's everlasting nature to the age of creation. In Psalm 90, verse 2, it says that God was God before the mountains, earth, and it's from everlasting to everlasting. At the time that was written, around one, that's, I believe, a Psalm of David, I believe. If so, you're talking 1000 BC. If that psalm was Moses wrote one or two psalms, if I recall, that would be 1500 BC, 1400 BC time frame. So, comparing God's everlasting nature, if Adam was created in 4004 BC, which is what the young earth proponents promote, we're only talking 2,500 years to 3,000 years. And we're comparing that time frame to the everlasting? I don't think so. Methuselah, who lasted almost 1,000 years, was one-third of that time, if you take a young earth perspective. Methuselah actually lived 960 some odd literal years. Proverbs 8 says before there was wisdom, before there was the created order, there was wisdom. Well, if wisdom was only present for 3,000 years, big deal. It loses its force of argument if we're only talking about 3,000 years ago.
That was kind of confusing to me. Why was it wisdom before there was order? And the other says forever. The earth remains forever and the everlasting mountain. None of those are true. I couldn't see that.
The earth remains forever. Yes, that is literally not true, but it means one heck of a long time. It's a metaphorical usage once again, you use a lot of things that say forever, but we just literally mean a longer period of time. So God's eternality is compared to the created order. And if the created order is only 3,000 years ago from the time that this was written, well, that's not very impressive, is it? So you would tend to think that just considering these passages in their context, that we're talking that the created order is a longer period of time. Now, what about some of their arguments? A common sense interpretation, they argue, is that a day is 24 hours. Simple. Let's get on with it. But as we saw, a common sense of interpretation of Genesis 1 does not allow you 24 hours. As we saw on day 3, day 6, day 7, and the Genesis 2 reference. So the common sense interpretation is a long period of time. Young universe individuals try to claim that whenever the Bible uses an ordinal, like first, second, third, like first day, second day, third day of Genesis, that when you use that ordinal with the word day, it always means 24 hours. It's a rule, some of them say it's a rule of Hebrew grammar. That is not true at all. There is no rule of Hebrew grammar that dictates that perspective. Okay? For example, look at Hosea 6:2, where ordinals are used. All biblical scholars say that the day as used in Hosea talks about, quote, after 2 days, he, God, will revive us, Israel. On the third day, he will restore us. Scholars are unified in their opinion that the day used here is a longer period of time, you know, maybe 1,000 years or 2,000 years, for example. And so the Bible actually contradicts what they're saying in terms of grammar. A young earth individual might say the use of evening and morning shows a 24-hour period. The rebuttal to that is that the Hebrews could use evening and morning simply to mean the beginning and end of a period of time. In fact,
and we use that in English too.
Yep. In English, we do similar metaphorical expressions or allegorical expressions.
I'm working at work is a fun thing on that project.
Yeah. And, well, talk about yourself, Al. I mean, you know. If you were to be a hyper-literalist, which is not a good thing, you're supposed to be literal when it's obvious as to be literal. When it's metaphorical, you obviously interpret it metaphorical, and the metaphor is referring to something literal. But if you were a hyper-literalist, evening and morning, evening began at 6 p.m. in Jewish reckoning. That evening, 6 p.m. And so evening and morning of the first day, second day, third day, and so on, would only refer to a 12-hour period. 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Morning, roughly 6 a.m. sunrise. So I would contend that young earth people actually should not be 6-day creationists, but 3.5-day creation. Or actually, I said 3.5 here. It should be 3-day. 3.5 if you include day 7, the day of rest. So it's only used to refer to the beginning of a period and the end of a period, and doesn't have to mean any more than that. Yes?
An implied meaning that a fellow named Gerald Schroeder, another WAG historian or scientist, contends that evening means a chaotic situation and morning implies order.
Hmm. Okay.
From chaos to order.
Chaos to order. Mm-hmm.
Right. So as God continues his creation process, 7 periods of chaos to order increase in order and information content and stuff as he's moving along.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an implied Jewish implication of mm-hmm. evening and morning.
The Jewish implication of disorder to order from evening to morning. We have to be careful in our 21st century culture to impose our colloquialisms or meanings onto pre-BC Hebrew colloquialisms or idioms. Got to be very careful about that. Some claim that Exodus 20, verse 9, that the and in verse 11, they show the days of Genesis to be 24 hours because they argue. It says, quote, 6 days you shall labor, but the seventh day is a Sabbath. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, but he rested on the seventh day. So they say, see, that means because the feast was 6 24-hour days. That means, therefore, creationist. Gleason Archer, one of the best contemporary biblical scholars that one can reference, in reference to this passage of Exodus 29 through 11, says, and forgive the full quote here, but I haven't memorized it. He says, quote, by no means does this, meaning this passage in Exodus, demonstrate that 24-hour intervals were involved in the first 6 days any more than the 8-day celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles proves that the wilderness wanderings under Moses occupied only 8 days. End of quote. And that's from Gleason Archer, for those who want to reference it. quote, a response to the trustworthiness of Scripture in areas relating to natural science, end of quote. And that's quoted in Hermeneutics, Inerrancy, and the Bible, edited by Earl D. Radmacher and Robert D. Patias, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Academic Books, 1986, page 329. Now you know why I didn't memorize. Also, you could argue that Exodus 20 is only one of five passages that deals with the Sabbath. Three of them don't even reference the Genesis week of creation. Okay? And this argument only holds any kind of influence if Yom is limited to a 24-hour interpretation, which it's not. And in Leviticus 25:4, the Sabbath is a whole year. Oh gosh, now one day is a whole year. So you see, biblical reality is not always as simple as some people try to make it to be. Thank God the gospel is very simple. Now here comes what sticks in the craw. That's the throat of a bird for those who are not ornithologists. What sticks in the craw of young earth creationists? Yes, Mara, this following argument.
Just to back up what Ted said.
Yeah.
I don't know if I believe that because isn't everything, I mean, that we just studied last time, how God, right to the, he removed the dime out of everything from the time of the universe. And I mean, if there was confusion and then things, I don't think there's confusion.
No, I don't believe there is any confusion.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what he was saying.
Oh, well, in the creation from disorder to order.
Yeah.
Yeah, like...
I mean, because he orders everything from the beginning. I mean, like you took out one dime. How could, on this day when he's creating, you know, this, that...
Yeah, instead of using the word order, use complexity.
Probably a better comparison for Ted's comment would be from simplicity to complexity might be a better word. It doesn't mean literal disorder or chaos. It doesn't mean chaos. It means, for example, you didn't have one life form on a given day and then you have a life form happening on that day. That would be from not that life form to that life form, in that sense, disorder to order, in that sense. But not literally chaos, no. Yes, Al.
But even if it was order, I mean, look at the universe. It's not an order to quit.
I beg to disagree with you. After you've been, after you've been in this class so long,
so it starts exploding, big, you know, giant.
And after Hugh's teaching, Al, and after to a lesser degree, of course, my teaching. Have I been with you so long, Al? Have you not heard? Have you not understood? That, and you missed one of my two sessions. There are over 1,000 finely tuned parameters needed to get an Earth-like planet. Over 1,000. And the week that you did catch, I only covered about four of them. And we were already, those four parameters had the random chance of happening of one chance out of 10 to the 217th power. That's one with 217 zeros after it. After you pass 50 zeros after one, it's impossible by statistical odds. And therefore, just four parameters show that it's not random. It has to be designed, and when you have design, you have a designer. Please listen to my second part on the web.
Okay, can I say one more thing?
Mm-hmm.
Big Ted has this little iPad or whatever it is,
uh-huh.
And he called up last couple of times ago in here, saying by Richard Heyman.
I'm not familiar with Richard Heyman, but okay, Feynman. Okay.
Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
He said you can take probabilities and go from tenth to a million zeros behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when that event happens, it don't mean anything.
Yes, it does. I'll explain why. What would happen if you flipped a nickel a million times and it came up heads every time? You would obviously logically conclude that that nickel's been designed to do so. Those are the kind of odds that I'm talking about. One time, an individual, when McDowell was talking about time, not in this sense of time, of creation. But somebody in the audience thought he was rather smart, and he says, "Oh, come on, McDowell, we know there's no such thing as time." You know, trying to be esoterical, right? And McDowell said, "What time is it?" He says, "It's 2:30." He says, "That's the time I'm talking about." You know. So the fact, if something is so improbable, it defines all odds. And as of 2006, and I divert for just a moment, that the statistical odds of all, at that time in 2006, we knew of about 674 parameters that needed to be just right to get at least one Earth in the universe. The odds of that happening are one chance out of 10 to the 570, roughly 554th power. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. And if you believe in that, I'm sorry, but, well, you have a much greater faith than I do, than I could ever have. You know, but if you believe in that, then your faith is much greater than mine, because I don't have that kind of faith and those kind of things.
But
yes?
In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, he says, the present heaven and present earth will pass away.
Yes, they will. They'll pass away.
And there'll be a new heaven and a new earth.
Yes, there will be. Eventually, there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. Yes.
I think you mean by impossible. Impossible based on purely natural processes.
Correct. Impossible based on naturally random processes. These odds show that it's not going to happen. Mara mentioned one in regard to mass. Some people argue why all the planets out there, all the galaxies out there just for this one Earth. Well, you need all that out there to get this Earth. Not at this present time, but just after the Big Bang. If you remove, which has the same amount of matter as the universe has now, but at that time, it was finally tuned to 1 out of 10 to the 60th, which means fill all the universe, all the galaxies, 200 billion galaxies full of dimes, remove one dime. No Earth, anytime, anywhere in the universe. That is only one parameter. We have over 1,000 parameters now that we can talk about. But lest I digress even further down that road, get back to our topic. And nobody in their right mind, I would conclude, I mean that with all due respect, would bet their money in Vegas on such odds. Those are the kind of odds that I'm talking about. You wouldn't dare, but yet you're betting your eternal soul against those kind of odds. Yes. For an atheist, for example.
What helps you there with the word chivalry?
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with that term.
It means basically an unfounded, irrational belief.
Ah, and that name is again?
Shibboleth.
Shibboleth. I'll have to learn that Hebrew word.
It ties to an assertion of that.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to learn that. I'll use it on Al every once in a while in our Bible study. Okay. If this is the thing that sticks in their craw on young Earth creations. If the universe and Earth are billions of years old, then there would have to be animal death before Adam's fall. That is a correct statement. That, they contend, that would contradict Romans 5:21 and 1 Corinthians 15:21, where it says that death entered through the fall or sin of Adam. Well, the people that make this claim are merely, in most cases anyway, parroting something they've been told and they haven't thought about what they're saying. They haven't actually even read the verses very carefully. Note, Romans 5:12 says, "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all men," not animals, "men, because all sin." Only mankind sins. Animals do not sin. This is limited to death to mankind, as this passage clearly states. And the 1 Corinthians passage says, "For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man." And that only resurrection is only coming to human beings. "For as in Adam all die." So, where very clear that this passage does not support that death spread to the animal kingdom through the fall. So therefore, we're not limited to having death, animal death, before the fall of Adam. When it really gets down to it, most of them claim this on a philosophical basis, an aesthetic basis. They cannot conceive that God would allow the horrible bloody mess of a T-Rex eating up a whatever, for example. God wouldn't allow that. That's too gory and bloody. Well, that is, and I emphasize, a philosophically based position, an aesthetic position, and it's not supported by any biblical text at all. Yeah, us city dwellers, I include myself, we have hypersensitivity about this kind of stuff. If you go to people in the country, the farms, they don't have a problem with this. You know, go out and chop the chicken's head off. We need dinner tonight. You know, so I'll become a vegetarian that day. You know. And so it's an aesthetic approach, not a biblical approach. In fact, in Job 38, 39 through 41, it says that God actually supplies the lions and other animals with their meat. And that's by the predator-prey situation. If the predator behavior were somehow innately sinful, why would God be supplying meat through that process if it were innately evil? Of course, he wouldn't, but since he does, it's not innately evil. Yes, Ross?
John, what they seem to miss is that the animals are just as innocent now as they were then.
Yep.
What's the difference whether he allows carnivore, carnivorous animal activity before the fall or after?
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference. And the predator-prey situation, you know. Yes?
When it says death came in through sin, does that mean temporal death of physical body? Or are they speaking about death meaning separation from God?
Well, it's emphasizing the spiritual, but the physical is all, as a consequence, is involved as well. You know.
Both?
I think so. In other words, would Adam and Eve lived physically forever if the fall had not happened? Probably not. But I wouldn't quote me as an authority on that statement. That's my opinion. Yes, Dave?
Yeah, the other one that the IRS obviously, as we know from scientific study now, that predatory activity obviously is beneficial to the ones that are being preyed upon, because obviously the predators take out the weak and the sick.
Mm-hmm.
And things like in Yellowstone, where we took out the predators, every animal there got sick. Beavers completely disappeared. And by reintroducing the wolf back into Yellowstone,
mm-hmm.
Half of the population is healthy. So we have predators not only not bad.
Yeah, the predatory thing weeds out the sick, the ill. And without it, things get totally out of balance. Yes, Al. Ted.
Well, what we have in our gut is more cells than we have our human cells, where we're constantly destroying them. We're
we have bacteria death in our gut.
Just, you know, and the whole microbial aspect of life and death and predatory activity is on a scale trillions, quadrillions of times.
We have more bacteria on us than we have cells.
Right, that's the point.
And think of that next time you kiss your spouse. Now, in Genesis 1, 29 through 30, it says that God gives men and animals vegetation for food. Yes, that's true. But that does not preclude him giving predatory behavior on the part of animals. It does not say he gave only the green food. The green food, the vegetation, is the basis of the whole food chain. You get rid of green vegetation, you destroy everything else on the planet in quick order. You know, it's the foundation or basis. And note, after the flood in Genesis 9, God adds meat to man's diet. So if somehow eating meat, carnivorous activity, were innately sinful, why would God be giving meat to Noah? And this occurred way after the fall. Yes.
Well, with regard to the animals, they're a different order of life form, a different order of creation. And they seem to behave. I notice, like with cats, when they get very old, they just find a place to be alone. I mean, is this something that's part of their natural expectation and so on? And so that it's nothing, it's nothing that needs to be troubling because their level of consciousness is a different order than human beings. The other hand,
it's just what they do. They don't have a consciousness. This could be bloody if I eat this mouse. You know, that's just what they do.
Human beings, the Lord created human beings as a higher order of life, a different order. And if Adam and Eve had remained compliant to all of God's instructions, they would have had access to the tree of life. And therefore, it's reasonable to suppose that they would never have physically died. Their bodies would have been continually renewed.
Yeah, that presents a very fascinating theological discussion, doesn't it? The tree of life. Even if we had a 6-24-hour day series of creation events, animal death was still unavoidable. You have bacteria death in your gut to digest vegetation. Just think of this. Then that means God would have to be running around. I use that metaphorically. Every time a brontosaurus or a T-Rex would put down its huge footprint, God would have to move all insects and bacteria out of the way of that foot coming down because they'd be maybe killed. Every time a brontosaurus would take some chomps out of a tree, you'd have to remove all the aphids and all the insects off of that tree before that chomp came because you have to prevent death before the fall. You see how ridiculous this ends up getting. And referring to reproduction and the male species, as you know, in every sex act, whether we're talking animals or human beings, there are millions of sperm involved. And guess what? Only one gets the prize, maybe. So all the others die. So you have death there. Does that mean God prevented all the animals from procreating the first week? Well, what does your common sense tell you? And what did your common sense tell you about Adam as soon as Eve was created? You see, so it doesn't make sense. Now, some young earth people try to say that these lower animals and plants are not alive and trying to get around some of these problems. But the Bible uses the same word for death for them, physical death, as it does for us human beings. Yes, Al?
So God creates Adam, who is a man, and he's got trillions of sperm. Is that why God is that how God created Eve?
No. No, he created Eve by a different process. No, he created Eve directly. That reminds me, here I go. I'm going to get myself into trouble. A joke where Adam was created and he says, I want a mate, like all the other, you know, animals have a mate. I want a mate. And he said, I want a mate that she'll go out and do all the crops and all the farming and milk the cow and clean house and make dinner and breakfast and lunch and the whole bit, you know. And God said, well, that's a pretty tall order. That'll cost you an arm and a leg. So Adam thought for a few moments and then he said, what can I get for a rib? The women can beat up on me later. Plus, if there was such a thing as all animals being non-carnivorous before the fall, have we ever seen any fossils of T-Rexes with molars? Isn't that a funny sight?
Yeah.
Make a good denture commercial. No, we haven't. God would have to recreate their teeth, obviously. T-Rex's teeth would not be good for a vegetarian diet. He'd have to recreate their molars, their tooth structure, their digestion systems, and it goes on and on and on. That would need to be required. And we haven't seen any before and after versions of herbivorous animals going, then later we see carnivorous versions of them. No, they stay the same from the very, very beginning. Okay, now, plus, God has... Yes?
The young earth objection to that would be that all the fossils we see were laid down at the flood, which was after the fall.
Right. They would claim all the fossils were laid down since during the flood. At last, that's another topic that I'd like to get into at some point. But it's interesting that even, and we'll be getting into this here shortly, that under the young earth paradigm, at as much as 30,000 species, as many, using their counting, the ark could hold no more than about 30,000 species. Well, why do we see then, right after the flood, millions of species worldwide? How did 30,000 species become millions instantly? Impossible. Absolutely impossible. In fact, young earth creationists, most of them, and maybe all, but that's a dangerous word to use, I'll say the vast majority, will acknowledge that the transformation of 30,000 species that got off the ark after the flood to become the millions of species worldwide, that process was totally a natural process, an evolutionary process. Not because they're evolutionists per se, but because God ceased his creation activity on the seventh day. So therefore, you're only left with a potential natural process to get from 30,000 to millions of species. And there's not an evolutionist alive or dead that would think that kind of speciation could occur that quickly. It's impossible. So actually, young earth creationists, by logical default, are avid evolutionists at this period of time, after the flood. Okay? Now this gets into something very interesting. Young earth creationists, and whenever I use that term, I mean this in consideration and love toward them. I don't use it in a derogatory term. They claim that Adam was created in 4004 BC. Okay? Yes?
There's one more thing they do. They pull out of Scripture, and I can't remember the exact passage, but that piece of Scripture, and I think it's in Genesis, talks about how plants are the source of food for all things. So that's one of the things they tie to saying, well, then lions must have been having salad.
Mm-hmm.
By the same extension, if you're only talking about 48 hours for the lion to get hungry, and you know, we know for modern day lions they eat once a week.
Yeah.
So then why was it an issue for God to put plants in front of lions to eat if they were only taking 48 hours?
Mm-hmm.
Your own case is kind of without merit.
Yeah, I mentioned that verse, not all the data that you just mentioned, but I mentioned that verse a little earlier about how the green plants are the basis of the whole food chain. You know, get rid of them, everything dies. You know. Now, 4004 BC, Adam and Eve. And Usher tried to claim it was, what, September or October, and even at a certain time of the day. I mean, they got ridiculous. And this stuff is 4004 BC is based on the genealogies in Genesis and First Chronicles and some other areas that the genealogies occur in the Bible. They claim that the names are contiguous, meaning no gaps between mentioning Joe and Larry after him. Is that true? We'll see in a moment. Yes?
Why do we have to be so passionate in calling young earth creationists young earth creationists? If they're young earth creationists, they should be proud of it. If somebody calls me an old earth creationist, I'm not going to be upset about it. You know, no. I don't get it. Why do we have to treat them?
Well, just because I'm using a label, and I want to make sure that people understand I'm using that label in a congenial kind of way, but I disagree with their teaching.
What I'm saying is, why do we have to be so careful calling them what they are?
Yeah, if they call me an old earth creationist, that's fine.
I go, right.
So let's assume their position is correct, that Adam was created in 4004 BC. Let's just assume that for the moment. There was 1,656 years from Adam to when the flood began. Noah was 600 years old. at that time. The flood lasted almost a year, meaning till the waters receded far enough where Noah and the ark's inhabitants could depart from the ark. So that means the flood ended in the year 2348. What problems are there with that?
600 years old?
Adam, Noah was 600. Oh, I don't have a problem with that. But the Egyptian Empire was in full swing in 2300. And the Sumerians before them. And others. An inescapable problem in chronology. Abraham was around 2100, 2000 BC. That means we went from eight people in a little over 200 to 300 years to the thriving empires and civilizations of Abraham's day in only, you know, around 300 years-ish. That's totally impossible. Now, we talked about the number of species progressing. So, and at this point, if it were, I were doing one whole lesson, I'd be shortly getting into the facts of nature or science. But some young Earth people try to claim you cannot trust the physics of the universe. You cannot trust your observations. It's sort of like a scientific Gnosticism, you know, ignoring of the facts. They say fallen individuals such as us cannot be trusted in their fallen interpretations of the fallen laws of nature. Okay? My response to that is they only come up with that because they can't offer any other possible way out of their situation, scientifically or really even biblically. Now, there's a nebula. Pretty one. What does the Bible say about nature? It says that it declares God's glory, knowledge, and therefore truth, and righteousness of God. Look at Psalm 19, 1 through 4. It says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech, and night after night they display knowledge. Not falseness. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard, and their voice goes out into all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In Job 12, 7 through 8, it says, ask the animals and they will teach you, or the birds of the air and they will tell you, or speak to the earth and it will teach you. Not falseness, but truth. Or let the fish of the sea inform you. In Psalm 50, verse 6 says, and the heavens proclaim His righteousness, therefore His truth. Same thing in Psalm 97, 6. They proclaim His righteousness. So when we look at nature, the Bible's position is we see truth and righteousness and the glory of God. Not falseness.
Which is why people are without
excuse. Yeah, and therefore in Romans 1 it says, therefore people are without excuse. That's correct. Now, so this fallen argument thing, fallen nature, does not hold water when it comes to biblical perspective. You could look at the heavens and nature and discern God's truth, His knowledge, His righteousness. Now, and all the facts of nature consistently indicate a multi-billion year universe. Okay? In fact, there are only, out of 5,000, roughly, 5,000 astronomers and astrophysicists, I know of only two who are young Earth, and they're only that because of their particular interpretation, which we feel is erroneous, of their reading of the Bible. And one of them was asked, do you believe in a young universe because of any facts of nature in terms of cosmology? And his answer was, no. He doesn't. Now, one other thing about the genealogies, which I think I'm going to probably do a PowerPoint just on the genealogies. Won't that be a fun Sunday lesson? That they claim you take the genealogies, they're all contiguous, meaning when it says, and John beget Larry, that means they're direct. Larry's a direct descendant. Direct, the next one. The son of, literal, as we would say, son of. Okay.
And, Steve Allen. I'm not a direct descendant of
Steve Allen, yes.
I'm a different one.
So they would claim that there are no gaps in the genealogies, put it another way. And when you add them all up, it's the 1,656, I believe, years from Adam to the time of the flood. Are they right that there are no gaps? No, they are not right. And that's another lesson which I can't get into. But, for example, in one of the strongest genealogies, I think it's in Chronicles, First Chronicles, where they like to point to, and they say, and John beget Larry, and Larry beget Joe, and Joe beget whomever. Those are contiguous, they claim. In other words, it says like, and when John was 156 years old, he beget Larry. And when Larry was 100 years old, he beget Samson, or whatever, not literally Samson, but and so on. And so therefore they claim they're contiguous, without gaps. But lo and behold, when you read Luke's genealogy, he inserts an extra dude in there. Right in the middle, between two names that are supposedly contiguous. Pokes holes in that argument right away. Plus, we have to understand in biblical terminology and understanding the Hebrew words, again, which are much more broad in their meaning depending on context than our typical modern English words. When you said, and John beget at 100 years old Larry, in our way of thinking, Larry's the direct son, the first son, or one of the direct sons. But in Hebrew, not so. Because in Hebrew, the terms for son or father can mean great-grandson or great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson and conversely, great-great-great-great-grandfather. For example, in the Hebrew way of expressing things back then, it could say, let's say I was a descendant of George Washington. I'm not making that claim, so I don't want to see it in the LA Times tomorrow. Okay? But let's say, hypothetically, I'm a direct descendant of George Washington. In biblical Hebrew, it could say, and let's say George Washington, let's say, had four sons. And let's say I'm the direct descendant of his first son. And his first son's name was Larry. And he had that son at, well, in George Washington time, would be at 100 years old. Let's say at 25, he had Larry. And I'm a descendant through Larry, that particular son of his four sons. In biblical Hebrew, it could say, and George Washington at age 25 beget John Davis. And that would be perfectly allowable to say.
Like my name, my last name, Allen, say I were the direct descent. If I, Fred Allen begat Steve or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have to be contiguous. You don't have to be immediate for it to be true. Yes?
Well, doesn't it say somewhere in the New Testament that somebody called Jesus the son of David?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's well, a son of or descendant of.
Yeah, son of David.
Mm-hmm. So again, when you look in the use of Hebrew idioms, those genealogies do not have to be contiguous at all. Now I have 4 minutes left, so I have to stop the questions. But I want to get into one or two things just on a scientific level. I can't resist it. There are many, many arguments against a young Earth, young universe. And I'll get into those whenever I do that session. But there's a couple of things that I would like to point out. And that lesson is based largely on Hugh Ross's. He had a sort of Jerusalem Council set up with about 13 evangelical Christian astronomers, well known in their fields, listen to his argument for an old universe and old Earth versus Danny Faulkner, which is one of the two young Earth creationists in the world. And then they reached a decision and wrote a paper. They unanimously, 100%, came down on Hugh's side heavily, but in a very congenial fashion. Unanimous. And this was a panel agreed to by Danny Faulkner as well. They weren't appointed by Hugh. They were agreed upon between the two individuals. Now, I like to point this out. If I only have one scientific argument to offer, I'll do, well, there's so many good ones. But I'll go into supernovas. Supernovas, when a sun explodes and it's so much larger, I think it's what? Is it a quarter size larger than our sun? It'll be a supernova. Less than that, it's a nova. But at any rate, whether a sun goes nova or supernova, takes it millions, if it's a humongous star, and billions for the rest of them before they'll go nova, explode at the end of their lifetime. But yet we're seeing, we have pictures of novas and supernovas all over the place. If the universe were only 6 to 10,000 years old, we could not be seeing novas happening. But let's go just a little further. There's no way they would go nova in the first creation week. And let's use creation week in the sense that the young earthers use it. So all the stars were intact by the seventh day. They were not going nova or supernova. But let's say the next week, and I mean calendar week, they started going nova or supernova. Impossible. Wouldn't happen. Takes millions and billions of years for them to go supernova and nova. But let's just hypothetically assume in the next 7 days they start going nova and supernova. Okay. Never happened, but let's say it does. Okay. That's only 6,000 years ago when they started in this hypothetical argument would be going nova and supernova. 6,000 years ago. Ah, okay. Then we know these stars, and this is not debated, we know these stars are, many of them are billions of light years away from us, some millions, some hundreds of thousands years. If the universe were only 6 to 10,000 years old, the light wouldn't have reached us yet of those explosions. Now, some young earthers try to say God created the whole beam of light intact in the creation week, so you could see Andromeda, for example, although it's 2 million light years away from us, you could see it because God created the whole beam of light intact from beginning to end, from Andromeda to Earth. Well, there's so much wrong with that that I don't have time to get into it. But that was in the creation week in their logic. Remember, as of the seventh day, God is through fooling around with the physics of the universe, even in the young Earth's perspective. God is not fooling around or creating new physics or different physics and laws of the universe. And therefore, the light of any nova or supernova has to arrive to us by natural physical law, even by their reckoning, in the second week and forward and onward. And yet we see these novas, these suns exploding. Impossible. Absolutely, totally impossible. Even using their own brand of logic and viewpoint. And lastly, we have the ice cores on Earth, like in Antarctica, go to 800,000 years ago. Each layer is a year. They try to claim, well, they're not necessarily annual, because there's multiple meltings and warmings and freezings. They say, well, that's true for southern Greenland, but not northern Greenland, and not for Antarctica, where they're annual. because we could count the number of layers back to the eruption of Krakatoa and Vesuvius in 79 AD. They match perfectly. So there's no way they can get around these ice cores. 800,000 layers. Yes?
Well, we have bristle cone pines that go back past 6,000 years. You know, trees.
Mm-hmm. I have one in my backyard. I chopped it down for firewood the other day. Okay. Well, that brings us to an end. I ended before Dave stood up and looked at me from the back of the room. So let's end in prayer. Lord, thank you very much for the words of your scripture, that we thank you that we can love you with all our minds as well as our hearts and souls, and the amazing consistency between your word and science, although in many cases it's taken thousands of years to catch up to your word. Thank you for our human intellect and the ability to glorify you with it. In Christ's name, amen.